Welcome back to Search for DOS. In this episode, we meet Ron Bar-Yoshafat. I reached out to Ron after learning about his experience speaking at UC Berkeley. On February 26, Ron was scheduled to speak on campus about his experience fighting in Gaza and the role of international law and the rules of wartime conduct. What transpired, even before he spoke, was a riot. 200 protesters stormed the venue, breaking glass at the entrance and forcing students and Ron to evacuate through a tunnel under police protection. When asked about the rioters' expressions of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, Ron said, "It is a much bigger problem than a Jewish or Israeli problem. It's the collapse of Western civilization." Let us not forget, Israel is at war. It is fighting a terrorist regime that has the explicit goal of eliminating Israel and the Jewish people. In an interview after the attacks of October 7th, Ghazi Hamad, a top Hamas official, said the October 7th bloodletting is, quote, "just the first time, and there will be a second, a third, a fourth, because we have the determination, the resolve, and the capabilities to fight. We will do this again and again." Ron is well aware of what is at stake, and he's putting his life on the line to protect not only his nation, but also the values and interests of the Western world. Many in the West are failing or flat out refusing to take the words of Iran and its proxies at face value. At this current moment, the words of Natan Sharansky come to mind. "Over the years, I've come to understand a critical difference between the world of fear and the world of freedom. In the former, the primary challenge is finding the strength to confront evil. In the latter, the primary challenge is finding the moral clarity to see evil." Natan Sharansky's quote helps put into context our conversation with Ron. As you will soon hear, Ron has the immense task of confronting evil. Here in the West, at this moment at least, all we are being asked to do is obtain the moral clarity to see the evil embodied by Hamas. We are meeting Ron today because few media outlets have chosen to amplify the voices of IDF soldiers. I encourage us all to listen to Ron and think deeply about his perspective and why he has chosen to fight for Israel's right to fight. Now, I give you Ron Bar-Yoshafat. Ron Bar-Yoshafat, welcome to Search for DOS.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
I came across you through the news. I saw the event at UC Berkeley that you were featured, you were speaking at, and I was disappointed but not surprised that it unfolded the way it did, and we'll get into that. But as I looked into your profile, I felt like you are the type of voice that really needs to be amplified at this moment. You've accomplished so much in your career so far. You understand what's going on in the ground on Gaza better than almost anyone, and more broadly, the history in Israel. And so I want to have a conversation with you for you really to speak to my peers here in America, because the way in which it's being covered is greatly lacking your perspective. So we're going to dive into that. Let's first start off with you and your upbringing, and for everyone at Search for DOS to get to know you.
I was born in Ramat HaSharon, which is a very secular area in Israel. I would say very liberal, progressive type of town. I went to a very good school in high school. My main focus at that time, you cannot see this on me right now because I'm out of shape, but I used to be the former national champion for MMA in Israel. So my time in high school was mainly training for the army and training for the MMA competitions. That was where I grew up. I served during the Second Intifada. Between 2000 and 2005 was the Second Intifada. My army service was 2002 to 2005. I served in a unit called Maglan. My job was to capture terrorists. I was a hand-to-hand combat expert, which worked well with my MMA experience. After the army, I went to work in a summer camp in America, Atlanta, Georgia. And that was my first real interaction with American Jewry. I flew back to fight in the Second Lebanon War. That was my first Army Reserves. After that, I moved to Jerusalem, where I got my law degree. So I got my law degree from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. My legal residency in Israel, before you take the bar exam, you have to have some sort of legal residency. So my legal residency was at the Israeli Parliament, at the legal department. After that, I flew to do Israel advocacy for an organization called Stand With Us. So I was in the Pacific Northwest for about 6 months. This was 2012. While I was there, I began my master's in business, my MBA, which I've done, finished after I came back, but I did it through the Tel Aviv University. After that, I got a master's in history from Haifa University, and hopefully soon I'll finish my PhD in history, also from Haifa University. I used to work for the Israeli Jewish Congress, and for the past 9 years, I work as the deputy director of the Kohelet Policy Forum, which is a think tank that deals with law and economics. What else can I share? I like to do Ironman competitions when I have the time and the ability, and I serve every year, regardless of this war. I serve every year between 1 to 2 months in the Israeli Army Reserves as an officer in Regiment 551, which is compelled from people who served in Maglan, Dovdevan, and Agoz, which are all combat special forces units.
All right. Well, you've been busy, and noted, I will not take a swipe at you. When you had conversations with people in the States in 2005 versus when you were just here at Berkeley, have those conversations changed in nature and the questions that people ask you?
Well, yes and no. In 2005, I think was the first time that I realized that some people in America see the world differently than how I see it. Like, I never thought someone would see me as the bad guy. I don't think it's, I have an opinion. I have a political opinion. I don't think it matters for this topic. I was capturing terrorists. Like, I would never imagine someone being on the side of the terrorists. And I don't think they understand that they are. You don't have to be pro-Israel. You don't have to be a right-winger. You need to be against terror. And that's how I saw it, especially during the Second Intifada, where terrorists would just go in coffee shops, buses, and explode. And then when I went to America, I was like, oh, you're an IDF soldier, you're the bad guy. I was like, what do you mean? I'm capturing terrorists so they don't detonate themselves on innocent civilians. So the fact that people are bashing Israel, that's not a new concept. There are newer things that people have been saying since October 7th, but it was my first experience. In 2012, I was on a mission to give lectures in different colleges, churches, high schools, and it was very bad, but it wasn't as bad. I spoke at Berkeley in 2012. It wasn't fun. I had hecklers. There was a very famous video of me in UC Davis when a student is shouting at me, how many women have you raped? How many children have you raped? You're a child molester, you're a murderer. I'm not surprised that when people are heckling me and shouting nonsense. But what I had now, it was violent. It wasn't hecklers. It was people rioting. So yeah, I do think that was different. Breaking the glass of the building, choking a Jewish student, spitting at another student, shouting at him, you Jew, breaking or springing the wrist of another, like, that was violent. So yeah, I do think it's getting worse. I don't think it's a linear line, meaning I wouldn't say from 2005 until 2024, it just gotten worse and worse. There were years it was better, years it were worse, but definitely it's worse now.
And when you were on campus, what was the talk you were going to deliver?
I was going to share from my experience in Gaza. I fought in the Gaza war that is still going on. And I will also was going to embed it with international law, because I do a lot of research in the field of international law. So to compare Israel to other places in the world, how international law is applied in the war in Gaza, what is the IDF doing? Actually, when I got on stage and I heard that there are people who were at that time, I would say, still protesting and not writing, I was like, you know what, I'm just going to give up the presentation. Let's do Q&A. I mean, they accused me of weird stuff. Let's just, you know, let them ask the first question. Did you write? Blah, blah, blah. I was like, no, I didn't. And let's just have a Q&A. I didn't even get to that. They didn't allow most of the students who came to listen to me. They weren't even able to enter into the hall. So I think 10 people were able to enter into the hall. The rest were stopped outside. I say this, I'll try to explain it like this. I think in a normal society, you're innocent until proven guilty. I remember in 2012, they were like, you're guilty unless you're able to prove that you're innocent, which I think is horrible, but okay. Here, I felt like you're guilty and you don't deserve a trial. And I think that's what made it worse than in the past. Like, we accuse you, it's a part of the cancel culture, in my opinion. Like, we accuse you something, that's it. And you're not even going to have a chance to say anything to it. I was like, okay, there's no dialogue.
How would you best describe, if you had that opportunity, what would you have said in that room?
I would share, first of all, what I did, my experience. And I would talk about the ratio of casualties, terrorists versus civilians. I would talk about what measures the IDF does to avoid hurting innocent civilians. I would share a few experiences that I've had. Try to draw a more vivid picture of what reality is like when you're at war, what it feels like, how you sleep, how you eat, the noise, you know, not taking off your clothes, your boots for a couple of weeks, like just so they'll understand what it's like. Maybe compare it to some other places. And then talk a little bit about international law, what is allowed, what is not allowed. That was the original plan for the lecture. I came back to Berkeley right before the end of my tour, and I gave a different speech. I told them, like, I cannot do what I was going to do. I addressed what happened the last time, and then I shared my army experience in Gaza and opened it for questions.
Let's talk about your time on the ground in Gaza this time around. Walk us through from the first day you went in and what transpired.
Sure. So like I said, every year I serve between 1 to 2 months in the Israeli Army Reserves. So I always have like a duffel bag ready to go in case I'm cold. October 7th caught me while I was planning my wedding. I was supposed to get married on October 11th in a very, very big venue, 500-600 people. I was in a synagogue, shul, getting my aliyah, hearing a siren. After the third siren, I was like, okay, that something's happening. We went outside. I saw a person I know who's a colonel in the IDF. He's a religious guy with his army uniform driving his car. I was like, okay, something happened. Went quickly to my apartment, opened my phone, understood. We didn't understand how horrible it is, but I understood I need to go right now to the army base, switched from my Shabbos clothes to my army uniform, drove to the base. And my main concern was at that time, my fiance, today my wife, because I knew that when she's going to be able to open her phone, to turn on her phone, I'm going to be in an officer's meeting. And when we meet together, the officers, we cannot have our phone with us because Hezbollah, Iran, and Hamas are tapping our phones. So eventually, when I was able to contact her, I said, what are we going to do with the wedding? We're obviously not going to have a 500, 600 people venue. Are we going to get married or not? And apparently that question was asked 50 years ago. Rav Eliashiv Zatzal was asked this question during the Yom Kippur War. And he replied that for such a serious question, do you postpone the wedding or do you continue with it? Only one person can give the answer, and that is the kala. If the bride says we continue with the wedding, you continue. If she says we postpone. My wife said we're going to continue. So on the fourth day of the war, I left my army base, switched my army uniform to my suit that I got for the wedding. We got married in a very, very small place. It's like a charity hall. I think we had maybe 40 people, half of them we didn't know. It just came to like make sure that we were happier. My wife's family couldn't make it. Like very few people were there. And then the next day I went back to the base. In the first 2 weeks, we did three main things. One, because it's an all-out war, it takes time until you give everyone their rifles and their equipment, their vests, their bags, whatever you need to train. The second thing is we searched for terrorists who are in Israel proper. Now, I fought in Gaza, Lebanon, Judea and Samaria, some other places to search for terrorists, where my battalion officer said, this is where me and my kids ride bicycle for leisure time. To search for terrorists there, it's a very unique concept. And lastly, we needed some time for the Arabs in Gaza to evacuate to the south. I'm not going to send my soldiers to go into a house that's booby trapped. We're going to bomb this house. But we cannot bomb the house if there are Arabs who are still there. So that's going to take a while. I think that was the first 2 weeks of the war. In addition, when the IDF reached the fence the first time, they encountered a gigantic pile of bodies. And then they were faced with a dilemma, because if a tank and a D9, a bulldozer, if they're going to run over these bodies, nothing's going to be left from these bodies. You wouldn't be able to differentiate the DNA, and you wouldn't know if these are bodies of missing people, hostages, or bodies of terrorists. So the decision was to extract the bodies and not go into Gaza. To extract the bodies is a whole army operation, because you cannot just go to the fence and drag a body. You have Hamas shooting at you while you're doing that. AK-47, RPGs, artillery. So that was a whole army operation just to extract the bodies who are on the fence, so we can find out if in these bodies you will find bodies of missing Israelis, people who we think are hostages, and so on and so forth. So that's how the war started for me. The experience of extracting bodies, which was definitely not something I was trained for. I served in combat special forces. So I know how to jump out of airplanes and work with helicopters and jeeps and reconnaissance and navigation. A lot of nice, cool stuff. Never was I trained to guard while a dentist who's not a soldier is being shipped into Gaza to go over people's teeth to find if these are teeth of hostages. That's not something that you're trained to do. So I had the experience to do that 4 times in my time in Gaza. 3 out of the 4 times we were able to find people who were Israelis. We found 2 bodies of hostages. One was a girl who was dancing in the peace festival, and one was a body of a soldier.
The coverage so far really doesn't dive into individual soldiers' experience in the actual war. And so understanding what it was like for you, you were planning on getting married with 600 people, and then you are all of a sudden on the front lines and you head back after a few days to get married in this, you know, life is going on. And yet the biggest threat to your nation in decades transpires, and you need to jump into action. I think it would be helpful to understand where we are right now.
Yeah, it's very hard to be outside of Gaza right now. On one hand, I feel relieved. I'm happy to be home. I'm happy to be with my wife, and it's a good feeling. On the other hand, I think I speak on behalf of every soldier I've met. We feel like the job is not finished yet. We need to go into Rafah. We need to find the hostages. We need to annihilate Hamas. And I would add, this is my perspective, we also need to annihilate Hezbollah. Israel is usually very good at sprints, not very good at marathons, but I think Israelis understand that this is going to be a marathon. It's going to be a very long journey. Basically, every square inch of Gaza is booby-trapped. The amount of tunnels that they have, I don't know what people, when I say tunnel, people sometimes think like it's a tiny tunnel that you crawl in. A tunnel can be a 4-lane road. Like you had Hamas terrorists driving jeeps from one side to the other. It's gigantic rooms. It's big, like I don't know, like a gigantic cinema theater. So these are about 400 to 600 miles of tunnels. Gaza is not 400 to 600 miles. It's a whole city underground that they build. The tunnel that we found the hostages, it was a 2-level tunnel, dug a few good yards into the ground, about 50 yards into the ground, and the length was almost 2 miles. So on one hand, I'm very happy to be home. On the other hand, I'm like, but I need to go back and finish the job. And I think that's how most soldiers feel. Yes, I'm going to be called again. The question is it going to be Gaza or is it going to be Lebanon? I have a feeling it'll be Lebanon, because most of the action in Gaza was in the first 2 months. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not saying there's not a lot of action going on right now in Gaza, but most of the army reservists that fought in Gaza were in the first 2.5 months, and now it's less troops on the ground. A lot of army reservists have been discharged. Also, a lot less airstrikes in Gaza right now, only when it's very, very surgically needed. So that's where we stand now.
And in terms of the concept of a ceasefire, because you sit here in the States and you hear calls for ceasefire, especially in the progressive world. What is, when someone in Israel hears ceasefire at this moment, what do you hear?
I'll give you my opinion. A ceasefire for me is an insult. First of all, we had a ceasefire on October 6th. It's a joke to say a ceasefire. Bring back the hostages and surrender Hamas, because Hamas are open about, I don't understand this, they're open about what they want to say. They say we're going to do October 7th again, and again and again and again until we kill all the Jews. So to say a ceasefire now literally means you're giving Hamas the chance to regroup. Hamas always played defense when we were in Gaza. So when we have a ceasefire, you have two things, two main things you have to think about the ceasefire. One is the negotiation. On one hand, you have people who were abducted, kidnapped from their homes. They're not soldiers. We're talking about Holocaust survivors, a baby that turned 1 year old. He's in captivity under a terrorist organization, Hamas. On the other hand, you have terrorists who are caught in the action and they're sitting in prisons. These are criminals, prisoners of terror. And then you want to exchange the two. That's one problem. It's problematic because you're saying, who are you exchanging in return for what? The people that you're going to give to Hamas are going to commit more acts of terror. So you're saying you're going to have more casualties from the Israeli side. And also for the family that have lost their loved ones, I think their tiny bit of condolences is the fact that the terrorist that killed their loved one is sitting in jail. So you're going to take that from them. That's the easy part. That's the easy part of the ceasefire. The biggest problem is that when you have a ceasefire every day equals an X amount of dead soldiers. That's what it means. Because it means that the Hamas terrorist, the son of former chief of staff, Eisenkolt, he was killed about 150 yards from me. He walked in a street that the IDF walked there before. But Hamas, because they had enough time, they came from a tunnel, and where they had explosives in the past, they just put more explosives in the same spot. So the IDF also didn't think that they're going to use the same location to put explosives there. So every single inch that you're going to walk to in Gaza can be a threat of booby traps. So now you're going to give them time to regroup and have more of that. That's horrible. That's what it means to have a ceasefire now. Obviously, the worst is that if you have a ceasefire, it'll be a complete truce. By the way, the luck of Israel is that our enemies are so horrible that they keep refusing a deal. I was in Gaza when we had a ceasefire. A ceasefire means that we cease and they fire. That's what a ceasefire looks like when you're in Gaza. So yeah, for me, a ceasefire is horrible. Saying that, you know, chas v'shalom, you know, I'm very happy that I don't have to be the person making these decisions. I don't envy the family of the hostages, and I think that they would need to do whatever they can to bring their family back. I don't think a ceasefire is the best way to do it, but for them, I want the hostages back, and if the only way to bring the hostages back would be a ceasefire, then I'm like, okay, well, then that's something that we should consider. I think the opposite way. I think that the more you pound Hamas, the better deal that you'll have. The more you'll say, we just want a ceasefire and bring the hostages, Hamas is going to bring the price up. That's how I understand reality. But yeah, I really hope that we will not have a ceasefire. I think Israel wants to bring back the hostages and annihilate Hamas. We have to.
What is the nature of Hamas leadership? From what you've seen, what is life like on the ground for someone who lives in Gaza and is engaging with Hamas? Because a refrain that I hear with individuals in the States who are really proactive about supporting Israel and creating a better environment for the region, say, free Palestine from Hamas. And so, from what you understand, what is Hamas leadership like day to day?
So Hamas's leadership is not in Gaza. Most of them are not in Gaza. They're not suffering right now. It's the second wealthiest terrorist organization in the world, right? We're talking about billionaires, not millionaires, billionaires. So they don't care about the suffering of their own people. I don't think people from the West who have not been to Gaza can really understand this. I'll share just one thing that happened. We were sending people from a no-go zone. We said, no one is allowed to be here. Not the IDF soldiers, not Gazans. No one is supposed to be there. As they were walking south, Hamas robbed them. They couldn't care less about their own people. I hear the same argument from pro and anti-Israel people. Some anti-Israel people are saying, Israel is carpet bombing Gaza. Some pro-Israel people are saying, how come you're not carpet bombing Gaza? Now, the thing is, Israel is not carpet bombing Gaza, but even if it would, it wouldn't help because all of Hamas are underground. It's a different mindset. When I'm serving in the IDF, I'm doing it to protect the civilians. Hamas are physically using the civilians to defend themselves. I want to emphasize this. It's not that sometimes you'd find a tunnel underneath a school or a hospital. It's that they build the hospitals and the schools and the mosques according to the tunnels. It's a national project. You have to understand. It's a whole different mindset. It's literally, it was like a joke for a PR. Every single house I went into Gaza had either Nazi propaganda, anti-Israel material, explosives, weapons, rockets. Every single house. I don't have one exception for this. Every mosque, hospital, or school I went into had a lot of those. It's like that's the mentality. It's a mentality of who puts explosives near children. Like, who does that? Who, when you have kids, you're sending them to school, and you know that, okay, this is the classroom where they learn algebra, and here in the other room you have rockets. Who does that? Who risks their own people like that? And at the end, you know that the IDF is going to have to bomb that area. Okay, but then you can say, oh, the IDF bombed the school or hospital. By the way, the IDF evacuates everyone there before. But anyway, so that's the mentality. Not everyone in Gaza is a big fan of Hamas. It doesn't mean that they're big fans of Israel. But not everyone in Gaza is a big fan of Hamas, to say the least. But yeah, I think that the leaders of Hamas really could not care less. Again, these are things they say openly. They say the Jews love life and we love death. And for them to hide themselves behind innocent people, it's great, because if we attack them, then they can say Israel killed innocent people.
Another refrain that I've heard in the States is that every time you kill a terrorist, you create two more. And I used to just kind of take that and was like, oh, okay. You know, it was something I heard during post 9/11 here in the States as well. But the more I read history, the more I saw counterexamples of that. There's two massive ones from the 20th century. There is Germany, Nazi Germany, and Japan when it was under imperial rule. And you look at those two nations, and not only did they denazify, did they deimperialize, they did it so successfully that they're now our two greatest allies. From those two examples, do you see opportunities to follow a path to basically de-Hamas, de-radicalize the Palestinian areas?
You know, if you take a cup and you fill it with water, eventually you can say the cup is filled with water. That is the amount of hatred that the Arabs in Gaza have towards Jews right now. I cannot make them hate me more. Literally, I'm not exaggerating. I'm not saying Nazi propaganda is a metaphor. I mean Nazi propaganda, swastika, Mein Kampf, Nazi propaganda, killed Jews. I don't think they're going to hate me more. I think they hate me to the maximum amount of hatred that people can have. On October 7th, about 3,000 Arabs entered into Israel. About 1,500 of them were Hamas terrorists. Let's say Hamas membership card holder. About 1,500 of them are what people refer to as uninvolved innocent civilians. These were not Hamas people. They hate the Jews so much that the atrocities, for those who do not know, I'm not going to go into graphics, but mutilation, cutting off heads, the rape, the horrible things that they've done, nothing I'll do will make them want to do it more. There's no more. What's more of that? If anything, I agree that if we use more force, then maybe they'll realize it's not worthwhile for them. So I'm not worried about creating two more terrorists. I'm saying, no. They want me dead. I need to make sure that they're not successful in doing that. That's the way I see it. I think that Israel cannot let them rule themselves again. It's not a sustainable solution.
Going back to the case studies of Germany and Israel, or sorry, Germany and Japan, Dresden, the Allied forces killed 300,000 civilians. Obviously, the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Unbelievable levels of force were used. And what came out the back end, incredible allies. And so it seems counterintuitive to an individual who is not well-versed in war, but clearly the intense level of force is something that has yielded positive outcomes. And so I have intense levels of empathy for you and your fellow citizens, because I think that there's From your vantage point, it is very clear, and it's you're constantly being berated by people in the West in terms of telling you all, no, that's not what it's like on the ground. And so I just been wanting to say this to an Israeli, and so you're my opportunity, is that I feel like it's insanity-inducing type of interactions when you've got individual citizens in the States as well as our leadership. There's now discussions about, you know, the day after and what that would look like. Is that something that you're spending time on, or is there not bandwidth to dive into that?
I can give you an opinion. It's just my opinion. It's not something that's solid. I don't believe that they're going to be able to govern themselves. Israel left Gaza in 2005, for those who do not know. Israel left Gaza completely. There wasn't a single Jew, soldier, or civilian left in Gaza in 2005. In 2006, Hamas took over. They went medieval on the PA, burning people alive, throwing them from rooftops. They did this to the Fatah, to the Arabs in Gaza. No riots or protests on that. And then they've gained power. This is my opinion, to let Arabs govern Gaza again, I think it's insanity. It's repeating the same mistakes from the past. Does it sound condescending? I don't know. I don't care. Like, they're obviously incompetent in making sure they can have a normal state. If they would have invested all of the money, you know, some of the rockets they were firing in Israel came from water pipes that was given to them. The amazing engineering abilities of these tunnels, amazing, a two-level tunnel. If they would use that to build a normal society, then Gaza would have been a Singapore, but they hate me more than they want to have a life for themselves. So for me, the day after cannot include them controlling themselves. The moderate, quote-unquote, PA in Judea and Samaria, what some people in America refer to as the West Bank, the moderate, quote-unquote, more than 70% support October 7th. They think it was a good thing to murder the Jews. They teach in their schools that Jews are descendants of apes and pigs, and if you murder a Jew, you would have a very successful future. They had elections in Judea and Samaria in 2006, and that was the last time. And the reason why that was the last time they had an election is because everyone knows if they'll have an election today, Hamas would win. The only reason why Hamas is not murdering Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, the leader of the PA right now, is because the IDF is there to defend him, to protect him. So for me, my understanding is that right now, I can only trust some sort of Israeli control over that area. That is my opinion. It's not the opinion, I think, of all Israelis. Though I think after October 7th, more and more Israelis are saying, what other option do I have? Israel left Gaza. Gaza never left Israel. They literally built tunnels from Gaza into Israel. They had no reason to do any of that. They attacked babies in their cradle and Holocaust survivors. It's a whole different mentality. They think that people who do not live there just cannot understand. By the way, ironically enough, the people who suffered the most on October 7th are the people who in Israel are considered to be the most left-wing peacenik people in the Israeli society. These are people who literally lived near Gaza to help the Arabs in Gaza. One family that used to fly kites into Gaza as a symbol of peace, the whole family was murdered. A woman that had a joint photography exhibition to teach Israelis about the suffering of Gaza, she did not know that the person who was doing this with her was actually a spy trying to tell later to the terrorists where to go. A person who drove Arabs from Gaza into hospitals in Israel to treat them is right now still in Gaza. He's kept in as a hostage in Gaza. Like, this is crazy. So yeah, I don't think that they should control themselves. I think that Hamas or the PA should not have the right to govern in these places. I think Israel needs to make sure that they do not grow in strength like they did. They shouldn't have been able to build 400 to 600 miles of, that is a tremendous amount of tunnels. It's just a tremendous amount of resources. All this money that could have gone to education, real education, not fake schools, not Nazi propaganda, real hospitals, not a hospital that's basically a place where you hold rockets and explosives. They could have had a normal society, but they don't. They want to kill me more than they want to live.
The prioritization is so troubling, and the resources that were totally blundered is the quantity is staggering. And talk about a sign that governance is not working out. I can't think of a better example than these tunnels that you're talking about, and the lack of care for the citizens. So I'd like to move to another area of expertise you have, which is international law. Why don't you share with us what, in specifically within international law, that you focus on?
So I write mainly about the UN. I focus on the rights of Judea and Samaria, Israel claims to Judea and Samaria. I would say these are the two main things. I wrote two policy papers about the United Nations. I came to a very sad conclusion that I don't think the UN should continue to exist. I don't think that the UN doesn't do good. I just think that cost-efficient speaking, the UN does more harm than good. And I've researched the bodies within the UN. Basically that's what I do.
What's your most charitable view of the UN's condemnation of Israel?
It's not just the condemnation. The UN, the way it's built, it has to be anti-Israel. It cannot be objective. Condemnation is one thing. I'll say you have two things. You have the condemnation in the General Assembly and the Security Council, which, for those who do not know, Israel has more condemnations against it than all of the other countries in the world combined. So one can argue maybe Israel is just the worst country in the world. Well, no, you can measure by the own UN's measurement. That's not the case. For the Security Council, they have a specific article that says basically no matter what is on the agenda, you also have to talk about Israel. So obviously Israel is going to be in the main focus. That's one thing. That's resolutions. The second thing is the bodies that are supposed to do stuff. I'll give you an example. An organization that's supposed to care for agriculture in Latin America uses its funds to have an anti-Israel conference. How is it relevant? I'll give you another example. If you visit the UN, you're allowed to just visit independently, or you need to take a tour. These are your options. Either you take an official tour or you just go and walk around, meet people there. If you take an official tour, you go to the Holocaust memorial section, and right across from it you have the Nakba, or the Arab catastrophe from 1948. So we have an equivalence of that. So every diplomat that ever went to the UN says, oh, the Jews suffered in Nazi Germany and the Arabs are suffering in Israel. It's the same thing, you know, for them. There was no wars. No, it's the same thing. This is just one example. I'll give you the UNRWA is the number one example, right? So all of the other refugees in the world, I'm going to give you a round figure. So I'm not being accurate here. Okay, I'm saying in advance, I'm not being accurate here. So if someone will say, no, it's not 30 million, 20, about 30 million refugees all over the world. They have one UN agency that deals with them, about 6,000 employees. UNRWA, which is just for the Arabs of my region, of Israel, has about 25,000 people working for them, which is a lot more, and has about 5 million people there. We'll talk about how we got to 5 million in a second. All of the other refugees in the world, the person who are giving the money are not the person who are receiving the money, right? The recipient cannot be the people who are allocating the money. For UNRWA, most of the employees are the recipient of the money. So you're allocating them the funds that you're giving, which is a problem by itself. So it's also in contradiction to the own UN charter, which says you treat all groups equally. So no, you treat all groups one way, and a specific group you treat differently. Let's continue. The definition of a refugee, usually you have a refugee because something happened, a catastrophe, a war, some sort of disaster, and then people are refugees and then they resettle somewhere else. For the UNRWA case, it only grows because the definition is, I don't remember the months, so let's say between the year 1946 and 1948, who were in the land of Israel and their descendants from their father's side. So you can be an American citizen and a refugee, which is a joke. How can you call yourself a refugee if you're an American citizen? You can be a resident of Germany, a citizen of the UK, adopt a kid from China, that kid would be a refugee under the UNRWA definition. it doesn't make any sense because they're not trying to resettle them. It's a political tool against Israel, which is how it has boomed into 5 million people. Let's take the accusation that Israel evacuated 750,000 Arabs from Israel. Like, let's say they get evacuated a million out of Israel, just for the sake of argument. How is it growing? Every other place in the world, it's shrinking. It's the only place where it's never going to go down. It's just going to go out, going to go up, because they're not trying to resettle them.
This is something that I think most Americans don't understand. And especially when they see UN attached to a organization, there is just this legitimacy that is given to it. And so this idea that there is an entirely different classification with regards to refugees for people in Gaza versus the rest of the world, what would the response be if we were to have a conversation with a policymaker in the UN who's upholding this policy, and we said, why is someone who was born in North Korea, who now lives in South Korea, not given the same status, this whole kind of through the father's line? What would their response be?
I don't know. I'm very happy if you have an answer. I don't. But hold on, I didn't get to the good part yet. This is just a procedural aspect. This is like the way it's built. This is before they've done stuff that's wrong. Let's take it up one more level. UNRWA has people who are also Hamas terrorists. So it can be people who are getting money from UNRWA and they are Hamas terrorists. It can be the fact that UNRWA allocates its funds for Hamas uniforms. UNRWA allocates its funds for a Hamas version of their Navy SEALs. And in October 7th, we also saw that UNRWA employees came into Israel, raped and murdered people. These are UNRWA workers. These are people from the UN. Hold on, the plot thickens. One of the hostages that was released in the previous ceasefire said that she wasn't kept by Hamas. She was kept by an UNRWA doctor. So it's not just that the body itself has a different mechanism when it comes to Israel and Israel only. And this is just one example. We have five different organizations in the UN that they vilify Israel on a daily basis. You have UNDP programs who are not helping women or poverty or climate change or whatever they're saying that they're doing. They take all of their allocation, all of their funds, and direct it completely to bash Israel. Put all that aside, they're supporting terrorists. Now, that was not new for me because, unfortunately, in Protective Edge, I lost three people I knew that went into an UNRWA medical center, which they didn't expect this to be a house of terrorists. And it was a trap. It was all filled with explosives and it collapsed on the soldiers. We saw so many bags with UNRWA that had handguns or rifles in it. So yeah, this is like the cherry on the cake. It's like, yeah, UNRWA is horrible. But that's just, again, one organization out of the UN that's problematic. I can also address the ICC, the ICJ. I can address the World Health Organization. There's so many other parts of the UN, again, wrote two policy papers about it that I'm happy to share later, that are unfair towards Israel. But the reason why I'm upset with the UN is not because I'm a biased person. I'm pro-Israel, I'm a patriot, I'm a Zionist. I'm not apologetic about it. So I have my agenda. The problem with the UN is not that. The problem with the UN is other stuff, is the fact that the Arabs of Judea, Samaria, and Gaza are getting more per capita than any other group in the world. Doesn't make any sense. They're not more hungry than the people in South Sudan or I don't know, like that's, or Congo. It's an organization. I'm not saying that they don't do good stuff, but the corruption and the straying of mandate that they have, forget about my conflict, is for other issues in the world, is horrible, is despicable.
What is the incentive structure, though, within the UN? Why has this continued to be such a, lack of a better word, lobby, a successful lobby?
That's a question for the American people. The main difference between the League of Nations and the United Nations, the two main differences, is America and America. Because the League of Nations was supposed to prevent a war in Europe, and it failed dramatically with the Second World War. And after the Second World War, they said, okay, let's have a different organization, this time with some teeth in it. You're able to actually do something. So the U.S. gives the U.N. a lot of money, and the U.S. gives the U.N. the let's call it the force needed to, in case something happens. So that's what we have right now. I don't see, because the US is there, basically the UN is still relevant. the day the US will say, you know what, these wonderful buildings that we have in New York, let's use this as real estate for something else, the UN is going to be useless. It was supposed to be a place for peace in the world. And as the world progressed, they added other stuff, which are, I'm not against. And world hunger, you know, empower women, better education, helping the environment, like this, okay, that's all great. It's just, that's not what really what you're doing. You're basically giving jobs to people. That's most of it. Projects like the UNDP, there was a book published about the UNDP and how they did a horrible work in Africa and mainly just got themselves some fancy cars. How is it that it has such a good reputation? Because the UN is supposed to be objective. It seems like when it's about Israel, the UN is not from the UN. When it comes to Israel, the UN has an agenda. I'll give you an example. We use terminology because we talked about resolution beforehand and said maybe Israel is just the worst country in the world. Maybe that's why we have so many resolutions against Israel. It's not because not the UN is biased. We're just horrible, more than North Korea, more than Iran, more than Saudi Arabia. We're the worst. Okay. So we looked at the terminology and we discovered that for any other conflict in the world, the UN is supposed to be PARV, objective, not taking sides. When it comes to Israel, the terminology is we condemn the illegal, aggressive of Israel. We went over all of the words in all of the resolutions from 1967 until 2016 was when we did the research. You had maybe 4 negative words for the rest of the world and like 10,000 negative words against Israel. It's a complete bias.
One of the silver linings that I see is that there are more people in the United States who are now focusing on the issues that exist in the UN. And my hope is that through conversations like this, more citizens of my country will be thinking critically about how that organization is structured. Because as you indicated, we have massive influence in that organization. And we should be focused on doing what we can to make it better.
Yeah, just so you understand what happens, the US government takes money from American taxpayers' money, gives that money to the UN. The UN then gives that money to certain organizations. Some of these organizations are actively using violence against American civilians. That is how crazy this is. Okay, so that's not most of the money, but some of the money, that's where it goes. Other parts of the money goes to fancy cars. I live in Jerusalem. I see the UNDP Toyota Land Cruisers that they drive. It's a very expensive car in Israel. So it's amazing to me to say, well, you want to solve problems in the world. I'm not against it. I'm actually very pro. I think that's a good idea. That's not the way to do it. That is literally corrupt. When someone is the receiver of the money and is also a person allocating the money, no non-for-profit would work like that. You would not accept this in any organization in the world. You're the person who's in charge of the money and you're going to decide who's going to, you're giving the money and you're receiving the money. That doesn't work. So it's not about not wanting to do good in the world. It's just not through these pipes. And I think that American taxpayers should, I'm not an American. I think Americans should take care about America first, but that's my opinion. But even if the main issue is right now to help starvation in Africa, which is a very worthy cause, the UN is not solving it. It's just not solving it. If anything, there's a book called The Compassion Industry. Sometimes people have an incentive to continue the poverty and the cycle of violence because they're making a lot of money while this is happening. It's good. It's almost worthwhile for them. Not the great volunteers on the ground who really come with their motivation to help people, but the businesses who are saying, well, right now, if there's a conflict somewhere, I'm making a profit of it. If they're poor people and I open a charity organization and say, you know, raise money to help them, I'm making a profit out of this. That's not helping people. That's helping the people who are making money on the expense of the American tax dollars.
It's clear that the priorities of the organization and how it's being incentivized is deeply flawed. And I appreciate the scholarly work that you're doing to shine a light on that. And please continue to do that. And I commit personally to be spending more time thinking about the UN, and especially in organizations that I'm involved in that are focused on the US place in the world. I think this needs to be a topic of conversation. Now, speaking about the US's place in the world, I think one of the elephant in the room throughout this war is Iran. And I'd like to close out our conversation with speaking about Iran, because it's not discussed nearly enough in the context of this war especially as Americans think about it. So I'd like to first dive into that through you explaining to all of us, how is Iran viewed in Israel?
Iran is not an Israel problem. Iran is a world problem. I'll say something very strange. I have no problem with the Iranian people. I hope that they will have peace with Iran. The Iranian people, I have no dispute with. I have a problem with the Iranian regime. Unfortunately for the Iranian people, they live under a theocracy, a dictatorship, a horrible dictatorship that wants to destroy Israel, but it really wants to destroy the West. I'm just the person in the gate before it reaches Europe and the US. Like, really, a nuclear bomb is very problematic for Israel. I think it's also very problematic for Europe and for the US. They already have rockets that can reach Israel. If they have a nuclear bomb, they can just bring it with suitcases across the border into America and cause tremendous damage there. Iran is the head of the snake. Iranians are not Arabs. They're Farsi, and they are Shi'i, most of them, those who are in control in Iran. Hezbollah, which is another proxy of Iran, are Arabs, but they're Shiite. Hamas are Arabs, and they're Sunnis. The war between the Shiites and the Sunnis is greater than the war between Arabs and Jews. But because of their hatred towards Israel, Iran is helping Hamas right now. How do you know that Hamas is involved? Because Hamas uses RPGs. RPGs are a weapon, anti-tank light missile, like a shoulder rocket, I don't know you call it in English, that was invented by the former Soviet Union. It was used in Vietnam. But the ammunition is Iranian from 2021, 2022. You see it. You have it. We captured a tremendous amount of it. That is how much Iran is involved. Again, for me, the problem with Iran is not, first of all, I don't think really Iran is an Israeli problem. I think Iran is a world's problem. But as an Israeli, I'm conflicted here because I don't have the Iranian, I have nothing against the Iranian people. So many Jews come from Iran originally, Farsi Jews. In Los Angeles, there's a joke that you have people who are from Tahrangeles, like Persian Jews in LA. I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with their horrible, horrible dictatorship, theocratic regime that hates Israel. And they're allocating all of their resources and energy to attack me through different proxies. Now they also added the Yemenite Houthim. That's the problem. So as an Israeli, if you ask me what is the number one problem, it's Iran, before Hamas, before Hezbollah. That's obviously they train Hamas and Hezbollah, they give them ammunition, they give them the explosives, they help them with the plans, they're tapping our phones. That's the main problem.
How did that orientation manifest, and how would you best summarize it today? What is their end goal?
So the question in Iran is, who's going to control the world? That's what they're debating right now. But I just want to emphasize one point. Why am I emphasizing so much the difference between the Iranian people and the Iranian regime? Because that's not the case in Gaza. In Gaza, there are so many Arabs in Gaza that hate me so much. Literally, again, I'm not exaggerating. I'm talking about Nazi. They're the closest thing that we have today to Nazi Germany. They hate me so much. Reading Mein Kampf, that's the only book I've ever found in the houses in Gaza. And I have a problem with the people in Gaza right now. Not all of them, not all the Arabs in Gaza, but with a lot of people in Gaza, I have a problem with. The Iranian regime is horrible. I don't think the average Iranian people wants to murder Jews. The Iranian regime wants to control the world. In order to control the world, they need to basically take over the West, because it's clear that today the West is in control. They're anti-West. It's always surprising to me, and people don't understand. They shout, Israel is little Satan, America is big Satan. I do not understand how people miss that part of their speech. It's very, very out in the open. They're not hiding it. So I think that Israel will have to get rid of the Iranian regime. I hope that Israel will have the guts to do it. I don't see this happening in the near future. But eventually we're going to have to go over the head of the snake. I'm just very, very sorry to see that as it looks right now, it seems like the world doesn't understand that that's what the world should want, not what Israel should want. That's what the world was supposed to say. Like, we, the world, should not allow a nuclear Iran. We, the world, should fight for the people in Iran who are suffering from this theocracy, this dictatorship regime. They're very good at PR. I think the Iranian regime, they openly lie. They're on Twitter. I'm not sure I have the best answer, like what's going to happen or who knows. I'm not sure that the steps that are being taken right now against Iran are working. And I think that, again, in my understanding of reality, Iran is a threat to the world, because for their ideology, their concept is who's going to dominate the world. First of all, there's an inner debate. Is it going to be the Shiite or the Sunnis? It's a whole different debate in the Muslim world. And then there's a debate of who's going to control. Is it going to be Islam under Ummah, under... I used to be a TA for Middle Eastern studies, so I also know a little bit about that. Is it going to be like the Muslim world, or is it going to be the West? And it's a war. This war can be conducted by firing rockets, and it can be a war that is conducted by sending people to different European countries, have lots of babies there until you have over 25% of a country. And then basically you're saying, this is a Muslim territory. We're going to change the rules. That's what it is.
I do think it's so important to frame this up in terms of Iran's intentions, which, as you alluded to, they make it very clear. And I think there is this desire to put our heads in the sand here in the States in terms of thinking that, oh, no, it's not actually, they might say that, but they don't really have those intentions. I once heard a saying, and this I think will resonate with you in a major way, that Americans are a group of people who believe history happens to others. And I think that outside of really 9/11, that has really played out. And Americans have had that dangerous luxury where the threats that exist in this world that you and your fellow citizens and of Israel are so intimately familiar with, we don't have those. We have not been confronted with those. And so we really have this bizarre notion that history happens to others and that we can kind of just sit in autopilot here. But each day that goes by that we don't take these threats seriously, we set ourselves down on a very dangerous path. Your experience, especially in the past few months, will hopefully really drive home to Americans that this is a very real threat. And the threat is not just anti-Israel or anti-Jewish, it's anti-Western. And Israel is just this incredible beacon of these ideas, Judeo-Christian ideas, ideas of democracy, ideas of liberalism that have just been so successful. You all have done such a great job allowing those to flourish in this land that, to much to the chagrin of many progressives, is the indigenous homeland of the Jews. And so I want to take it home with a quick fire. Is there a specific quote from an Israeli leader that really inspires you?
Well, actually there is one. Because I just want to say, I really agree with you. And even what happens, not just in Gaza, and also what happened to me in Berkeley, for me, it's not just a Jewish issue or an Israeli issue. It's a war against Western civilization. That's the way I see it. I'm fighting not just for my self-determination and for my independence and for my safety. Freedom is not free. And the people who were rioting against me in Berkeley, they were not just fighting the Jews or the Israelis. They're fighting the concept of free speech. And that's how I frame it, and that's how I understand reality. Regarding a quote, actually Netanyahu's father, Professor Benzi Netanyahu, he published in the New York Times in the early 1940s, he had this slogan, says, "Jews fight for the right to fight." And I understand that there are people in America who are not big fans of Israel. And you know what? I prefer always to be hated and protested against, but to have the ability to hold my gun and protect myself than being butchered and then have someone have a hashtag pray for Israel. So yes, my quote that I have is Jews fight for the right to fight. And that has not changed so much. Right now, you see people arguing and saying, Israel has a right to defend. Why do we even need to say it? Like, why do we need to convince others that when someone is coming into my country from another entity, raping and murdering our women and children, I am allowed to fight back. Why do I even need to argue that? So that's, so it hasn't changed that much. Jews still fight for the right to fight. The difference is that now we have an army, so we can actually do it.
Thank you for sharing that. And as an American Jew, I have immense respect and derive a lot of inspiration from you all really being focused on that. And, you know, never again, right? The motto after the Holocaust, it will be never again. And 10/7 was a scary moment that really put that in jeopardy. But thanks to you and your courage and your valor, you're making sure that the Jewish people around the world will always be able to fight. Next question, in terms of your military service, and I don't know if this will be a quick fire question, but is there a takeaway, a kind of learning that has that you feel like you would have never gotten if you weren't training and then deployed to the front line?
It's funny. I just had a conversation with a young lady who was debating between herself if she should serve or not. She's a British girl. And I told her the pros and the cons. And I say there are many things that you receive in the IDF and in army in general, I would say, but definitely in the IDF that are not, that you cannot get anywhere else in the world. One is the ability to meet other people. You have the Ethiopian Jew and the Russian Jew and a guy who's a new immigrant from America and the guy who's a kibbutznik and the guy who's religious and the guy who's secular from Tel Aviv. And you have to get to know people and you have to get along with them. Like you're with them in the tent or your bunks, whatever, and you have to get along with them. Like, that's it. You also have the ability to grow as a person, because your commander can have an awesome commander and you can have a horrible commander. But it's like having a boss, only you cannot resign. So you have to build, you have to develop a character. And that's even before talking about combat. For me, I don't think there's stuff I can do in civilian life that would be equivalent to the feeling of capturing terrorists and preventing them from exploding in a coffee shop, murdering innocent people. I'm defending the lives of Jews, Christians, Muslims, vegans, whatever. I'm protecting everyone from people who want to murder them for no reason. So that is something amazing that you get in the army, that feeling of satisfaction. That's if you go into combat.
Final quick fire, your speeches going forward, if there was one U.S. institution that you would like to speak to, what would it be?
Congress. I'm a big fan of America. I don't want to be an American citizen. I love Israel. That's my one true love. I'm a big fan of America. I read the Federalist Papers many times. I watched Hamilton. I think that the concept of America is amazing. With all of the troubles that you have in America, it's an amazing concept. America brought to the world democracy in the brightest sense. I am a tremendous admirer of the American people and the American concept. It's always shocking to me to see Americans who are so anti-America that they curse and I was like, just leave. Like, why don't you spend a few months in some other countries and see how great it is that you have the ability to live as a free person? If you ask me where I would love to speak the most, Congress, definitely. I'm not sure why anyone would invite me there, but yes, that would be my answer, Congress.
I hope one day you are able to deliver that speech to Congress. And as a proud American, it is heartwarming to hear what you just said. And I've always seen myself as an American Jew instead of a Jewish American. And I actually felt that strongly when I went to Birthright, which, you know, I don't know if the goal of Birthright is to actually for it to be flipped and, you know, to see myself as a Jewish American, but it's just the way I do see it. I am an American first and foremost. I think about a line that my grandfather said to my father. My grandfather was born in Ukraine. And my dad, when he was, you know, 7, 8 years old, very curious, he would ask my grandfather, he'd say, "What was it like where you grew up?" And his response to that was, "Why would we talk about a place that is so bad when we're in a place that is so good?" And I, each and every opportunity that I've been given, specifically the academic institutions that I went to, I think about my grandfather and how he probably couldn't even envision that his grandson would one day attend them. And I am so grateful for America and the opportunities it's given me, and specifically the Jewish people. And so I see my personal responsibility is to my country and to make it as strong as possible and to ensure that my country is aligned with Israel. And that's one of the most troubling things I've seen since 10/7 is this this contingent in the States, which is still a minority, but it's loud, and they doubt the connection and the importance of championing and celebrating Israel. So I could say to you that for the rest of my life, I will be fighting in whatever way possible to ensure that our nations are linked and that we both thrive and that we ensure that our values and the values of the Jewish people are alive and strong.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And thank you. Thank you for putting your life on the line, all of the bravery that you've showed. Finally, mazel tov on your wedding, and we'll celebrate soon.
Thank you so much.
Yerushalayim, kol zatzon, mekol sifat.